Thank you and welcome to Picasso's. We are so glad that everybody is here for the May version of On Tap. Tonight we'll be talking about the death penalty and issues surrounding that. Before that, we do want to mention there are some specials tonight. We do have beer. We have the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, Black Mesa Blonde, or the Kingpin Red Ale on special. And with that, with your first pint, you get a miniature beef Wellington. So take advantage of that. And we thank Picasso's for letting us be here once again. We always enjoy this moment to be able to come to you and give you information that you need, especially in a timely manner. And one of the things we do know about the death penalty is it hit national headlines in Oklahoma recently with the botched execution of Clayton Lockett. And that's why we wanted to bring this conversation to you. It's also made some changes recently, and both of our panelists will talk about some recent changes with the death penalty. To start us out, we have Dr. Rick Tepker. He is an OU professor of law. And we also have Scott Rowland. Scott Rowland is the Oklahoma County Assistant District Attorney under David Prater. The reason we have these men, Dr. Tepker has written many papers, many articles, and has actually been in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. And Oklahoma County District Attorney, Assistant District Attorney Scott Rowland has been involved in death penalty cases. He's a prosecutor. So this isn't so much a pro and con, so much it is to give you information about the death penalty. And so I know this is a very highly sensitive topic, so we do want to remind you to try and be as, what's the word I'm looking for? Genteel as possible. And what's that?
Civil.
And try to keep it as civil as possible. And we thank you very much. We're going to start out with just a 2 to 3 minute statement from each of our panelists. And then we'll open it up to questions. So get your questions ready. Dr. Tepker, let's start out with you. And just your thoughts on the death penalty. And especially, could you please go over what the U.S. Supreme Court has recently made a ruling on Florida's death penalty law?
I oppose the death penalty, but I must say I'm probably not the best person to consult because my arguments are professorial. They're complicated. As we were talking about it, it's very difficult to develop a language to make progress on the moral issue of the death penalty because there are so many conflicting views. But I'd like to make just a couple of points that I think ought to be of importance to all citizens. The first is, after the botched execution, which you all know about, Oklahoma's been embarrassed. There has been a wide range of attacks and criticism on Oklahoma's reputation. And it's part of a pattern in American history where Oklahoma has frequently been on the wrong side of important moral, constitutional, and political issues. Now, that itself is not a reason to change an opinion, but it is a reason to rethink. I think it's very regrettable that we had a state Supreme Court justice who decried the claims of the inmates as frivolous, when all they were doing is trying to make sure the execution wouldn't be botched, that it wouldn't result in extended agony. It is a fact of American history, legal history, at the Constitution and the original meaning of the Eighth Amendment. The ban on cruel and unusual punishment is a ban on extended agony as a method of criminal punishment. Oklahoma failed its duty under that original understanding. The other more basic point is probably more of a policy argument than a moral argument, but it seems to me the death penalty system rests on rage. A kind of manufactured, maintained, manipulated anger. And as your mom and dad probably taught you, you shouldn't be making decisions when you're angry. And yet we have a criminal justice system which makes mistake after mistake after mistake, partly out of indignation over brutal crimes, and partly out of frustration over the conditions that lead to violence, that are violence. The criminal justice system is not well served by handing over to government the ability to decide questions of life and death. If you believe that government isn't good at taxing, spending, building roads, I don't know why you would want government deciding questions of life and death. The piece of news that I think he wanted me to report is the Hall case from yesterday. A 5-4 decision of the United States Supreme Court, a closely divided court, an ideologically divided court, struck down Florida's practice of saying, if you've got a IQ of 71, you're eligible for the death penalty. You've got to have an IQ of 70 or below to be ineligible. The five justices, speaking through Anthony Kennedy, said that's not consistent with standard medical practice, and therefore it's not consistent with the cruel and unusual punishment clause and its protections for human dignity. It's a new decision, which, as the dissent points out, does establish new ground. But I think it's, in part, a judicial reaction to the horrors of the death penalty. Justices have spoken personally over the years about how they fear what will happen in these cases, how these cases haunt. And I would ask you to think about what these cases are doing to prosecutors, prison guards, victims. This manufactured rage leading to these executions are not therapeutic, they're not helpful, and they're not justice.
Scott, let's give you a couple minutes also. Just as a prosecutor, it's something you deal with personally. You've even had some dealings with it today. So talk about your personal experience with the death penalty.
Like Dr. Tepker, I do not oppose the death penalty, and perhaps I'm not the best person to consult here tonight. I told Michael Cross when he called me, I said, I'll be glad to come do this. My boss, David Prater, was invited, and he couldn't be here. And I said, I'll be glad to come do that. But if you're looking for the rabid pro-death penalty prosecutor to come in and try and sway some minds, that's not me, Michael. I said, I can live with it. I can live without it. But I'll be glad to come in and take part in dialogue. So it is from that ground that I proceed here tonight. I am the first assistant district attorney here in Oklahoma County under David Prater, and primarily I supervise the 55 or 60 other lawyers in our office, and I try a couple of cases a year. I'm currently involved in three murder cases in which a bill of particulars has been filed. I think maybe the best thing for me to start out with in the, what, minute and 19 seconds that I have left now, is whenever we start off on a murder case, first off, we do not ever make a decision on whether to seek the death penalty when the case is filed. We have sort of an unofficial arrangement with the Office of the Public Defender that we will not even make that decision until they have the ability to sit down with us and make known to us what they see as mitigation. Now, of course, mitigation comes in at the much later down the road in terms of punishment, but if there is indeed mitigation that would sway our opinion, we like to know that up front and never file the bill of particulars and seek the death penalty at all. So we've built in, since we've been back in the DA's office since the end of January of 2007, that kind of consideration. But before we even make that call, I meet with the family, surviving family members, and talk to them. First off, here is what's going on with your case right now. Here's what you can expect. And all murder cases, the victim's family want to know, is it the death penalty case? Sometimes it is because they are adamant that they want to seek the death penalty. Probably almost as often, it is because they themselves are opposed to the death penalty and do not want that to enter into the justice system on behalf of their loved ones. And so I always tell them, here's what you can expect. There's gonna come a day, if we do seek the death penalty, there's probably gonna come a day when I'm gonna ask you to come in and talk to you about a plea bargain in this case. And I try never to talk them into or out of being against or in favor of it, because they don't have the ultimate say-so. I even don't have the ultimate say-so. Our boss is the only one who can make a decision to seek the death penalty or not, or to back off from it. But it sometimes seems to me that I'm trying to talk the victim's family out of being in favor of the death penalty in this case whenever I hear the words coming out of my mouth, and it isn't that I'm trying to talk him out of it at all. But at some level, I suspect I must think that it is in their best interest not to, because I hear myself saying, first off, here is what it does to the case in terms of making it more lengthy, more complicated. It adds these built-in dynamics to the case. If we are successful in getting a conviction, and if that conviction carries with it the penalty of death, and if everything goes perfectly, there's never any error found at any level, state or federal, appeals-wise. Right now, the average time between the imposition of that punishment and carrying it out, as of today, is 12.6 years. And you, family, need to know that for 12.6 years, this is an open case in your mind. For 12.6 years, every day when you pick up the newspaper, you may read that something has happened. I recently had to be involved with a family where the case has been reversed after almost 20 years. And I'm telling you, I felt like I had an ice cream scoop reopening the scabs on their wounds. So I told Dr. Tepker, I said, you know, there is no way that I'm going to try and debate someone into or out of support for or against the death penalty. This, unlike any other area of criminal law that I've practiced for 20 years and I've been in law enforcement for 25, this is a stew of not only one's view on criminal justice, but their political views and very often their most intimately held moral, perhaps religious or social views. It's all that together. And so I really don't even take part in these discussions with friends or family anymore, because short of something like this where you have people who will sit down and engage in a dialogue and be willing to really go the long haul, it really is useless to me to hear someone say that I'm opposed to the death penalty, here's why, or I'd flip the switch myself, which is what you used to hear back in the days of the electric chair. So I would actually make myself available tonight to give you a glimpse into my world and answer questions rather than try and sway your opinion. That I won't do.
Of course, that's a good practice in any family setting. I know myself. First, do we have any questions to start out with for either of these gentlemen?
Michael?
Yes. All right.
Other than first-degree murder,
are there any other aspects, any other charges that would be involved in the death penalty in Oklahoma or other states that you know of?
In Oklahoma is all I can speak to. We have one other crime in Oklahoma that carries the death penalty, which is certain forms of child abuse. Speaking only for myself, I think it's about as unconstitutional as it can be. It's never been stricken down, but under the paradigm of the existing case law, I believe that the death penalty for anything other than first-degree murder and with aggravating circumstances won't survive constitutional scrutiny. I will defer to the professor to correct me.
Always a mistake to defer to a professor, but
and a lawyer.
treason is punishable by death. I think there are probably some other offenses in federal law associated with levying war in the United States that would generate a death sentence. I don't know whether it would be sustained by the court. Since the death penalty has been reconsidered by the court in the 1970s, we have not all that many occasions to consider and reconsider the federal death penalty statute.
Scott, has a child abuse case ever been? I know, probably not in Oklahoma County. Is it any other state that you know, or any other county?
No, it has not.
Okay, that's which is why it hasn't been challenged.
That statute's been on the books for, you know, time gets away from me. It seems like 5 or 6 years, so that means probably 9 or 10 years, right, but not over that.
And certainly speaking as a Capitol reporter, every few years it does come up that that they try to add sexual assault or rape. There are other reasons for lawmakers do, but nothing's ever passed.
Yes.
From a prosecutorial standpoint, why would the prosecutor in this case that just was botched not come out on the side of opposing using a cocktail of drugs that isn't proven, administered by a person who shouldn't have been administering the drug, placed in the femoral vein, which is well known to rupture on an IV? Why in the world, in the name of humanity, wouldn't some of the prosecutors in this state come out and say, that's too much?
I can't answer that. I don't know. I do know that with regard to that particular case, I think both the prosecutors who tried that are no longer employed as prosecutors. I'm trying to stay close to the microphone that they warned me to do earlier. And one other thing to note, and I'll warn you up front, I'm not going to attempt to delve into the minds of them and answer your question. I don't know why they didn't. It is important to know that in Oklahoma, the trials are handled by district attorneys and assistant DAs like myself, and then not only in capital cases, but in all criminal cases, the Oklahoma Attorney General's office then steps in and handles it, and we don't have any legal jurisdiction over the case after that. You asked from a humanitarian standpoint, why didn't they step forward, and I do not know. I understand the point you're making by your question.
Dr. Tepker, do they have any kind of legal standing? Do you think that they should have stepped forward and said, you know, that a prosecutor should have stepped forward and said something like this?
Well, regrettably, the state Supreme Court concluded that the inmates didn't have legal standing, that their claims were frivolous. I do not know what claim a prosecutor would make. They could speak to a microphone. But I think, really, this is the job of the Department of Corrections, the Attorney General Office, and it involves a question of making sure that the death penalty process, the actual execution itself, conforms to medical and scientific standards. The problem that they're having is that a number of the professional associations and drug companies are refusing to cooperate in all of this. And I don't know what a prosecutor could do or say about that. But the prosecutor is responsible for presenting the evidence and making the arguments to a jury, and then someone else is responsible for deciding whether there is an error in law. That's the criminal process. The question of how the execution occurs is primarily a scientific and medical process.
Okay, we got a question right over here. Oh, sorry.
Hello. My name is Dr. Martin Biggs. I'm a former regulatory affairs consultant. I have two very short questions for you. How do you compensate murderers who are falsely convicted? Does that ever enter the minds of prosecutors? And secondly, are you aware that the people involved in this recent execution are almost certainly committed several regulatory federal offences concerning the off-label supply and administration of drugs?
With regard to your second question, no, was not aware of that, but don't claim to be. That conviction did not arise out of our county, and again, at the risk of sounding like I'm pointing the finger at somebody else, I don't keep up with convictions out of other counties. Ours go to the Attorney General's office, and honestly, I probably know less about that case than you do. I was a consumer of the news, but nothing more than that. Even if it had come out of our county, I probably would have known a little bit more about it, because even though, as I mentioned earlier, I wouldn't have had any legal standing in it, I will tell you that I would have made it my business to find out what was going on with it, and I would have interfaced with the Attorney General's office. What I would have done subsequent to that, I just can't say, because that's all speculative. With regard to the first question, what do or can prosecutors do to compensate murderers who are falsely accused? There's nothing we can do. That is why there is this enormous responsibility, it isn't even an adequate word, on the part of people in my job to make sure that we don't prosecute. Now, is it a perfect science? It absolutely is not. Was started out this morning before I even got my first cup of coffee, before I even made it to my office. I stopped in the office of one of our assistants, and there were some what we call baby lawyers, some younger assistant DAs in there. And I wound up giving this lecture about prosecutorial discretion. The point that I was making to them was the law does not constrain you in what you're about to do here, and that is why you better darn sure check yourself. Prosecutors have very, very wide discretion in who to prosecute, how to prosecute. Most of the time, that works splendidly because we are almost immune from political influence. Now, I'll wait for you all to respond to that, and then I'll say it again. The office that I work in, I'm here tonight. My boss didn't tell me. He asked me to come here and say and do what I think is right. And it's strange to have a job where you've never been asked to do anything except what you think is right. And it has to be that way because one prosecutor who does something even a little bit wrong can do enormous damage in that case and enormous damage to the public's confidence. And you can all think of your favorite example. I don't have to tell you that. That is why And I'll, you know, boast a little bit here. I've got a case that I'm involved with right now. We're set for trial next month. It's a death penalty case. This defendant has opted to represent himself. He asked to speak to me 2 weeks ago in court, and he said, your reputation is that you're a real honest and fair guy, and you'll tell the truth, so I want to talk to you. And I told my wife that night, I said, you know what, this would sound strange to most people for me to consider that a compliment from him, but I do, because I know that that is what comes out of our office now, because we strive for that. We charge somebody falsely with murder, or for that matter, almost any other crime. With a stroke of a pen, we alter their life forever. God forbid they're executed wrongfully. There isn't any way to compensate them. That's the real answer to your question. I have to make sure it doesn't happen on the front end. Now, I guess the more ephemeral answer probably is the legislature has passed statutes lowering the bar a little bit. It's almost impossible to get compensation from the government short of a civil rights lawsuit. The legislature has lowered the bar in the last 7-8 years to allow for some compensation. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there is anything to compensate somebody who spends even 5 years in prison falsely. There just isn't. And for me to try and defend that or tell you that most people are guilty of something, and honestly, most people who get even acquitted of a crime, most of the ones I see are guilty of something. That's irrelevant. It doesn't matter because we don't try them on general principles. So I'm not going to try and defend that, and I'm not going to tell you tonight that there are ways we can make that up to people. We can't. We have to make sure it doesn't happen on the front end. That's my job as the supervisor of these lawyers, and that's what I promised David Prater I'd do when I came to work for him 7 years ago.
We got a question right over here.
First, a comment and then a question. With respect to your question about in Oklahoma, how can someone recover if they're wrongfully convicted? Under our Oklahoma Governmental Tort Claims Act, there's a cap, and I think it's $250,000 or $175,000 is all that you can recover. So there's a cap to that. With respect to Mr. Lockett's case, his co-party in that civil case was Mr. Warner, and his case arises from Oklahoma County. So my question to you is, what, if anything, is the Oklahoma County District Attorney's Office going to do? Because as you likely know, if you read the paper, his execution was stayed, even though he should have been executed within 2 hours of Mr. Lockett.
What are we going to do
for Warner's, in Warner's case?
You said you didn't really know anything about Mr. Lockett because that arose from another county, but Mr. Warner arose from the county for which you work. So what's your position with respect to his execution? That's currently still set in November.
Well, right, we're going to be in contact with the AG's office. Now, again, the only thing that we can do is contact them and see what if anything, they're going to do to stay that further. There isn't any question about his guilt or innocence as far as I know. Correct? Yes, ma'am. But the appellate issues are, and she was not on mic. She said he claims he's innocent. But as I understand it, the only issue that you're talking about is whether or not the same issue that came up in the prior one. The only thing that we will do is to, what a boss of mine used to say, squat and watch, talk to the AG's office and see. Let me give you an anecdote. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. I started to go down another path.
Okay.
The issue in that case was the secrecy surrounding the drugs and also everything relating to the execution process. So does the district attorney's office have a position on whether or not that should be secret?
Not yet. We don't. Right. It's not something that we've ever...
Do you have a personal opinion on whether or not you think that should be secret?
Please speak into the microphone.
I thought I was. My personal opinion on whether or not it ought to be secret? No, I really don't. Honestly, it's not something... No, I can't think of a good compelling reason to keep it secret. Does that help you?
Let me Dr. intervene here. I think this issue is now before whatever process the governor has created to evaluate the methods of execution. Now, I have doubts whether that process of review is something we can trust, but... What we need to do is to make sure that those federal regulatory issues and the scientific issues and the medical issues are presented to that review so that a sensible decision is made. That's not primarily the responsibility of the local prosecutors or even the local defense attorneys. That really involves the state, which has undertaken this task of putting people to death, and they must do so in a professionally acceptable way that minimizes pain and agony. That's the obligation imposed by the Constitution. But what I hope is that that review process is open and clear and reviewable, so we can see what sorts of decisions they have come to. One of the worst things was this effort to force the issue. There is such a kind of stubborn streak of certitude in the legislature and in the body politic to force these things, to force them quickly, and that's partly responsible for the botched execution. They were experimenting, they were improvising, they didn't do a good job. Simple as that.
I refused earlier to speculate on what we might do. I will give you this information and you may draw your own conclusions. We were, my boss and I in our office were once involved in a case where there were two people sentenced to death. The first defendant's conviction was overturned on appeal, sent back to us. The second one, identical crime, his was not, because his appellate lawyers did not raise that appellate issue, even though the same infirmity, the same problem existed in both of them. The second defendant was procedurally barred. In other words, because of the laws and federal habeas, he could not go back and claim that, and his execution was set to go forward. And we took some steps which put us at odds with some of our colleagues higher up the chain in the criminal justice system, and we confessed the defense motion on the second one as well. Because what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Even though legally we could have stood our ground and maybe forced that well, it wouldn't have been executed yet, but forced it to go forward, enforcing the law equally, we confessed that against the advice and against the wishes of people who were handling the case in court. So that's what we did on that one. I think that was the morally and legally right thing to do. I like to think whatever the legally and morally right thing to do on the one coming down the pike is, we'll make the same decision, but I wouldn't speculate beyond that.
Right over here.
Yeah, this question about the cost of the death penalty or in a false conviction. Are you familiar with Ron Williamson and the Dennis Fritz cases? I heard that Pontotoc County had to... Ron Williamson, Dennis Fritz had been convicted, but they were exonerated by DNA evidence, and I heard that Pontotoc County had to raise their property taxes to compensate them because the settlement was so high.
I would not be a bit surprised. I'm generally familiar with that case. As you mentioned, it happened down in Ada back in the early 1980s and was the subject, of course, of a book and a movie. I don't know what the civil judgment was, but I can tell you that when a county incurs an extraordinarily large civil judgment like that, about the only way they can typically satisfy that is to raise property taxes. And so while I couldn't raise a hand and swear an oath to what you just said, I wouldn't doubt its truth. I'll bet it's true.
Let's talk first off, because this did remind me. Let's talk about the cost, and not just about defending somebody in a prosecutor or someone who's exonerated, but the actual cost. And Dr. Tepker, I know you've done some work on this about the actual cost when it comes to the death penalty as compared to, say, life in prison without parole.
Well, everything I've ever seen, and I haven't done the work myself personally, suggests that the cost of litigating over and over again these death penalty cases far exceeds the cost of putting people in prison for life. This is a expensive governmental spending program that doesn't work. It does not reduce measurably the incidence of crime, the incidence of murders, and we're spending a huge amount of money for good lawyers. But it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense if you look at it that way. I would much rather see more money spent on increasing the personnel that goes after child abuse, where there isn't enough money and there isn't enough personnel. I think there are a wide variety of law enforcement objectives that are underfunded and undervalued in favor of these death sentences. I think the most extraordinary example of that was the effort to prosecute Terry Lynn Nichols. I mean, we spent a huge amount of money just to get the same verdict that the feds gave, and I just didn't. I never saw the sense in that.
Scott, so does cost enter into your decision at all when you decide?
No, it does not. And I wouldn't want to live in a place where prosecutors made decisions based solely on dollars and cents. Do I have to make the bottom line budget with the budget balance with my boss? Of course we do.
But what's it worth to put an armed robber in prison? That evolves very quickly into math that I'm just not capable of doing. What we evaluate in terms of, again, filing any case at all, murder to larceny, and I don't mean to trivialize murder or capital murder or anything like that, but every time we file a charge against anybody, I sign a piece of paper that says I've examined the facts and I swear that I think probable cause exists. You alter that person's life forever. We do that about 8,000 times a year on felony cases and about 4,500 times a year on misdemeanor cases in this county alone. For every one of those, if I were to figure out is it worth it or not, no. What we look at is, has this person committed a crime? Is society's best interest furthered by prosecuting? Are there mitigating factors? There are times when I know a person has committed a crime that I will not charge them for one of several reasons. Now, never on a murder case. Mm-hmm. With regard to the cost of this, I wish I had a screen up in front of me like they have in the cheap bars to keep the bottles from flying at this point for what I'm going to say. But I challenge you to examine your own mind. Is it really the cost? People who are opposed to the death penalty, I don't see many who would be fine with it were the costs lower. And so, I'm not trying to be facetious at all. Those are views that, as I said at the outset, are so closely held to your political views, to your views of what is humanity, to your views of what is moral, right, just, and meet in terms of your religious viewpoint. So I don't mean to sound like I'm not interested in that fiscal argument at all, because I spend every day looking at numbers, you know, and we try and take good care of your tax dollars, but I'd be lying if I told you that made a big difference to us in terms of how to proceed in what we think is just in a given case.
I'm right over here.
After we work out, mesh out the whole moral aspects of the death penalty, lethal injection, if that does come to be done away with or, ruled unconstitutional for whatever idiotic reasons, do you see us returning back to other death sentences like, hanging or other electric chair, gun firing squad, stuff like that that's more, instant death kind of thing?
There are a lot of
states. Just to add to that, there's a state, Kentucky, I believe, was it Kentucky or Tennessee, that just recently said that you could...
There are a lot of states that are having this problem of securing the drugs that are used for lethal injections, and these states are considering returning to these primitive methods of electric chair, shooting, hanging. And I think the spectacle that will occur is going to have an impact on people's thinking about it. I find that a horrifying prospect.
Is there any legal reason the Supreme Court, they just basically said, in 1976, they said when it was allowed that any form of execution, or was it, did it have to be lethal injection?
Well, the Supreme Court upheld an awful lot of executions when it was the primitive methods, and I know of no decision which has foreclosed those methods. It did reach a decision a few years ago which said that it's not the obligation of the state to totally eliminate pain in the course of an execution. But of course, that's not the issue. The issue is whether or not there's a duty to minimize it as much as scientifically feasible. And so I think we'll see a wave of relitigation of these issues. And if Justice Kennedy is making the decision on the basis of the principles he put into the Hall case, he's going to cite the concept of human dignity in ways that I'll probably find very difficult to teach and explain, but in ways that will have unpredictable restrictions on the death penalty.
Scott, do you see us going to any kind of other form of execution besides lethal injection?
I'm not sure about the wisdom of me trying to predict what the legislature would do in that regard. I don't know. I don't think so, but that's Scott Rowland, and not speaking through any kind of research. Probably nothing even scientific or legal at all. I will tell you this, and maybe this will get me back in the good graces of the crowd here a little bit after the last comment. I have a sense that juries have become more discerning, more reluctant to impose the death penalty in the last 10 years or so. And again, I've seen polls that go both ways. I've seen polls that show waning support. I saw one today online that said even in the wake of this of the execution that you're making reference to, that there's still, I think, 61% nationwide or something like that. And I don't pay a lot of attention to polls. I'm not a politician. I should probably confess that up front. Probably never could be one.
But do you think if a jury were told that if you give the death penalty to this person, he's going to be executed or shot at a firing squad, do you think it'd be harder for a jury to say, okay?
I think it might. Now, again, there's no such thing as a jury. There's whatever 12 people are left after right. Both sides deselects those. But, yeah, I think that that's possible. I can tell you that there's been a change in prosecution in Oklahoma. I don't think just in Oklahoma County, because I don't work in the other counties, but I have some interaction. I believe that there's been a real change in prosecutors selecting cases to seek the death penalty. We went almost 2 years in Oklahoma County. And it wasn't that we were intentionally trying. We do not try and say, we need to get a death case here. We need to get not. I'll tell you what, I would be delighted if we went the next 4 years and didn't file a single death penalty case. I absolutely would. It's Dr. Tepker alluded to this earlier, and I was kind of surprised. I was thinking yesterday that I had never heard anybody say this. It has got to take a toll on the prosecution, although I've never seen anybody admit it, any prosecutors. I know that it takes a toll on the defense bar that does it time and time again. Every time I'm involved in one of these cases, either from trying it or just observing, most of the time my respect for the defense bar involved in it is only heightened, because most of the time they are defending somebody who in any other context than fighting for their life is indefensible in terms of what they did if they did it.
Did you still have, yeah. This is Nicole.
Hi.
Nicole Robinson Carroll, if you heard her in the morning.
Yeah. Hi. It's late for me. It's past my bedtime. But in any case, kind of following a central thread that's been part of this issue recently and part of this discussion, the secrecy involving drugs for lethal injections, it seems like there should be some way to put a system in place that identifies the type of drug, the efficacy, the purity, or what have you, while still maintaining the supplier's anonymity. So I'm wondering, other than the pushback from drug companies, what the roadblocks are to accomplishing that, and also one of the reasons with drug companies being reluctant to follow this and identify their drugs and, you know, admit that they're supplying them is they're worried about protests and other things. Do you gentlemen really perceive that much of a threat for that sort of thing, you know, protests or any other sort of public retaliation for that?
A lot of these drugs are secured from Europe, and Europe's attitude toward the death penalty is quite different than America's, so I'm not a great expert on what the European political or cultural conditions are, but I think the companies have backed off in part because of European public reaction. And I don't know whether that will change.
Oh, I've got a question right over here.
If the purpose is to kill people, and that's the purpose, then it seems to me that the guillotine would be the way to do that. And if we're not willing to support that, then we should not be willing. I mean, because what we're trying to do is find a nice way to kill people. And I don't think there is a nice way to kill people that I've come up with, but let's make it the guillotine. But the other thing is, if we've got all these issues, if it's not, maybe it's not a deterrent, and maybe it's more expensive, but probably is. Morally, I don't know any place in the New Testament where it says we ought to do this kind of thing. Does not it boil down to this is strictly political? And most of the executions, I understand, happen in the South. That's where people are executed, not so much up north and out west or California. So what is it about the conservative and mentality that says this is the way to go on this issue? Is it because it's we don't want to be soft on crime? Can you shed any light on that?
Well, I'll try. I feel completely inadequate for the questions that are being asked tonight because they have to do with things that are really not in my milieu. I can tell you I'm going to stop short of saying it's strictly political, which I think is the qualifier you used. It absolutely is political to a degree. Yes, there are legislators who believe that it's soft on crime. I have told legislators to their face on non-capital issues, this law that you're considering, which appears to be helping prosecutors, is harming us to the degree that you take away discretion. I'll give you an example. I'm not gonna veer away, but just to try and illustrate what I'm talking about here, on a second degree rape, you got a guy who's 18 years and 3 months old, and his girlfriend's 15 years, 11 months, and 29 days, and they have sex, and we have to charge them because there's a crime committed, and the family's in here standing on our desk. They're entitled to justice. We can't give him a deferred sentence. We can't give him probation. It's statutorily ineligible now. You can get a deferred sentence for almost every other type of nonviolent crime. So our choice is to simply not charge him at all, or charge him and he winds up with a felony conviction. That was passed by legislators who were just sure that that was a good thing to do because you shouldn't have sex with underage girls. And so, yeah, political considerations sometimes are frustrating. I can't answer for you the so-called, you said, conservative mentality of wanting to kill people, etc. I can tell you that I have interaction with a lot of people who are either not opposed to the death penalty or in favor of it. Usually they believe that there is nothing else to do to this person which is just for that which they have done. Case has come up recently, and I don't want to give any names to this because it is very much an active and open investigation right now. A guy was convicted of murdering somebody in a certain county back about 2002. 10 or 12 years ago. A witness testified against that person, and they both went to prison. The former, life without parole. The other one, I don't know, probably 25 or 30 years for his cooperation. 5 years after the trial, the Department of Corrections put them in the same cell, and the first one beat the second one to death. That happened in 2008. And so the first inmate received a second sentence of life without parole. He's got two of them now. The evidence would indicate right now that this same guy ordered an execution about a month ago in your county. I'm at a loss as to what to punishment to impose on him to stop him from doing that anymore. Now, if you are adamantly and morally opposed to the death penalty, that argument will not sway you, and I don't mean it to. What I'm trying to tell you is these things come to my desk not in terms of politics, or in terms of social justice issues, they come to our desks in terms of, what are you going to do about it, Mr. Assistant DA? This is the law, and these are the facts. So those are the things that we wrestle with. And so I don't know why conservatives tend to be pro-death penalty or not. I'm not a political scientist, and I'm sorry, I can't answer it.
Dr. Tepker.
I think the issue is political, moral, and cultural. And the enthusiasm for the death penalty in the West and the South is more cultural than anything else that manifests itself in the politics. But I think we'd be incomplete if we didn't acknowledge that racial politics played a long, horrific role in the Southern enthusiasm for the death penalty as a means of social control. You use the word conservative, and I'll just break into a quirk that I've got. I don't think this is conservatism. If you think about where conservatism came from, it came as a response to the horrors of the guillotine. It came in the philosophy of Edmund Burke. It said you should not create a government which makes decisions on the basis of anger, passions, fury, the mob. And what we've got is a system which is deeply influenced by anger, fury, and something pretty close to the cries of revengeance coming from a mob. I think a genuine, bona fide conservatism would say limited government, limited power for government, and let's respect the idea that government does not know enough decide questions of life and death. I hope there'll come a time when conservatism will return back to its roots, its intellectual roots, and conservatism will be the heart of the anti-death penalty movement. Admittedly, it's not something that's happening now.
Are you ready? I grabbed her mid-bite, so give her a second.
My question is for Dr. Rowland. I'm wondering, the states that have outlawed the death penalty, are you aware of their history and how they were able to do that? Was it through public protest, or just that they're just they just think differently than we do?
Dr. Tepper, yeah, there's like 15 states I think that have eliminated it. So,
yeah, they had protests, and it was done primarily through a political process. Many of the states then restored it. Some states eliminated it, then restored it, then eliminated it, then restored it. I believe Kansas might be the one I'm thinking of. I know New York has been in that situation. There is very little common pattern. Back in 1972, there was a death penalty moratorium nationally imposed by the Supreme Court, which eliminated all of the death penalty statutes in the states. And so there was kind of a pushback on the part of a number of states to restore valid death penalty statutes. But it's a long, complicated political history. There have been times when the death penalty has been opposed by majorities. I remember in the late 50s and early 60s, the death penalty actually did not have national majority support. But I think one of the unintended consequences of the moratorium and the restriction of the death penalty to a very few cases is those cases tended to be more brutal. The crimes tended to be more cruel. And the horror of public opinion was regenerated in support of the death penalty for a few cases. So the death penalty has majority support right now. I think there's a settled consensus that it's constitutional, but it's constantly churning in terms of opposition and how it can be opposed.
And right over here.
Hi, my name is Mary Sine, and I'm with the Oklahoma Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. And for those of us who do oppose the death penalty, the question of cost is one that's mixed in with the question of religion. And so I direct my question to the Assistant Attorney General, District Attorney.
Close enough.
Good. Mr. Rowland.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to ask, this is another question about secrecy. Our organization has been trying to get figures on what are the actual costs for putting somebody to death in Oklahoma. At every turn, we've been denied that information. Would your office be open to providing information about how much it costs to put, for example, a single man to death?
Give you anything I've got, but I don't, again, I think you're asking the wrong office for that, but absolutely. But by the time the execution is carried out or even gets close to it, that case is generally 8, 10, 12 years removed from the district attorney's office, so much so that sometimes the prosecutor has moved on, either retired or something else. But to answer your question, you bet. Well, any cost figures you want out of our office about any dollars spent on anything, and I don't want to go do a research paper for you, and you don't want me spending my time doing that, but to the degree those numbers exist, be glad to do that. It's not going to be as black and white as I think you're hoping for out of our office. So what it's going to show is these two lawyers who make this salary spent this much time on it, et cetera. And I'm not trying to denigrate the cost factor at all. I'm telling you that at least at our level, it's there will not be a spreadsheet that shows the dollars allocated to that particular case. For instance, today I was telling Dr. Tepker and Michael Cross earlier that even as late as today, I was on a docket, a status conference on one of our capital cases, but there were 82 other cases on that docket as well. I didn't handle all 82 of them, but I pitched in on a few of them, so how much of my time was spent on that. But sure, be glad to give you any. That's your dollars. Those are your records. And I'd be glad to share them with you. One of the things we haven't talked about while you're getting your next question is most of what I've heard tonight, and always hear, again, is it has to do with people's heartfelt beliefs about the rightness or lack thereof of imposing capital punishment. That's what this is always about. Now, the courts don't strike these laws down or uphold them based upon that. The courts are ruling on the constitutionality or lack thereof, and what governs here is the Eighth Amendment, which bans cruel and unusual punishment. And what the standard that the courts have used since, I think, 1958 or so, the U.S. Supreme Court, is the Eighth Amendment imposes the evolving standards of decency that are marked by a maturing society. That's the benchmark. And so that's why things that were
perfectly permissible under the Eighth Amendment back at the time it was first passed. I remember the debate by a guy named Livermore, I think, from South Carolina, who was debating the Eighth Amendment, and he said, in essence, now, we got to be careful here, because if everybody agrees you're going to want to cut the hand of a thief off now and then, we want to make sure that we don't preclude that. Well, you know, that makes you recoil in horror now. So it's this sense of evolving standards that the Supreme Court applies as the legal yardstick here. We hadn't talked much about the law tonight. I wanted to throw that out insofar as this is an educational forum.
Which is why when we're talking about the Supreme Court going back and forth, sometimes it's about what the majority believes at the time.
Oh, well, thank you, because you just kind of led into what I was going to ask. I'm going to change tack just a little bit. This is a fascinating discussion worthy of a lot more consideration and talk. But to go back to the things about conservatism and about politics, I did not understand exactly what happened when the Oklahoma Supreme Court made the injunction, and then it got changed. And I didn't know how that happened unless it was just politics or so. But I was very concerned about separation of powers, okay, which is, I consider, conservative interpretation of Constitution.
Dr. Tepper, can you answer what, do you know what led up to the Supreme Court basically saying that they held the injunction, then the governor said you can't do that, and a couple had threatened impeachment?
Well, I must confess that as those events were happening during those days, I got a torrent of phone calls trying to get me to talk about what happened and why, and I ducked them all. The reason for that is Oklahoma has an unusual system. It has two courts of last resort. One covers criminal cases and one covers civil cases. Unfortunately, you don't have a clear definition of what's what. For example, if you're talking about the judgment of guilt and the assignment of an appropriate punishment, that's pretty clearly criminal jurisdiction in the Oklahoma Supreme Court. Doesn't have anything to do with it. But here we're talking about something else. We're talking about a method by which a government agency carries out its mission and whether it conforms to federal regulatory standards and scientific practices and medical practices. And there's a decent argument that that is civil. Beyond that, I have no idea. I do understand that the Oklahoma Supreme Court backed off. And I don't know why or how. There's probably a story to be told there. But I think it has something to do with the conflicting views of two courts that arguably had jurisdiction over the same matter.
You don't see this arise very often in Oklahoma. And when it does, it rarely, if ever, is this interesting an argument so that folks like you care about it. But that's exactly what happened here. You have in essence, two top courts in Oklahoma, the Supreme Court that handles civil cases and the Court of Criminal Appeals, which handles the criminal cases. Now, there is a constitutional provision that says when there's a question of which one has jurisdiction, that the state Supreme Court settles that. But I've had this come up a handful of times. I took part in prosecuting a state legislator about 2 years ago, and there was much pretrial litigation on that. They challenged much of our evidence, claiming that it violated the speech and debate clause, that to prosecute legislators for what they deemed legislative activity violated that. And so they tried to appeal that before a trial to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, which sent us all down the street to the state Supreme Court. And so before a juror ever heard a shred of evidence in that case, I had argued before the state Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals. And it's unusual for a case to go before either appellate court pre-trial. And it was because that was a civil-ish issue that was completely embedded in a criminal issue, just wasn't nearly as interesting as the one that we're talking about here, where the life or death of the accused is at stake.
Right over here.
I'll just disclose, I'm the lawyer who brought the case on behalf of Lockett and Warner, so I can't actually explain to you what happened, and I can at least argue our point as to why it was a civil case. And I am one of the people that asked Mr. Tepker, I gave your name, to speak about it. And
I've been set up here.
We were sad that you did not disclose.
She's talking about the reporters on the day.
Yes, I knew it. Yes, I gave them your name. But anyway, What essentially happened, it's a statute that states in all civil and criminal proceedings, anything relating to the execution, including the purchase of the drugs, and this goes back to your question, the law as it still stands today, we don't have the right to know where they even got the money to buy the drugs. They've kept all of that secret. And so our interpretation is it says within the own statute, it applies to civil, criminal. We brought your typical civil declaratory judgment action, which is what you bring when you challenge a statute not being constitutional. Within the very statute, it says in a declaratory judgment in Oklahoma, if the Department of Corrections is a defendant, you file it in Oklahoma County. So the very statute we brought it under already understands that the DOC, who was the defendant, can be sued civilly the way that we did it. What happened is the remedy, which we were requesting as part of the case, was that our client's executions be stayed, because it had to. And the reason it was brought when it was is because we had an execution in January that had gone wrong. We had an execution in another state that had gone wrong. And that's what brought the case to where it stood when we filed it. The Supreme Court first said, okay, Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, we don't want to create precedent granting stays. We're going to give it to you. Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals said, no. No, they don't have standing to do this under our criminal statutes. We're not going to grant a stay. It goes back to the Oklahoma Supreme Court. They say, really, we don't think you heard us. We think this is, and that's paraphrasing, we think this is a really important constitutional issue, and we would ask you again to reconsider staying. Goes back to Oklahoma Court of Appeals, and they say, really, we're not staying it. Goes back to the Oklahoma Supreme Court, they stay it. That's a Monday. Tuesday, the governor issues an executive order that says the Oklahoma Supreme Court, in her opinion, has exceeded its power. With all due respect, I think she said that, with respect, that she has respect for the court, but they exceeded their power. So she, on her own, was directing that a new execution date be set, essentially, and asking the DOC and the Attorney General to go about trying to get a new date set. So the same day, the legislature, or at least one or two, tried to introduce a bill to impeach the five Supreme Court justices who granted the stay on Monday. Wednesday, the Supreme Court reversed itself, issued an opinion. They didn't even address three. There were three issues on appeal. They only addressed two of them. I would invite you to read the opinion, and you think what you think about with respect to how much time.
May I ask you a question?
Addressing it, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I cannot stay silent any longer.
No, I understand. I bet you want to answer this question.
And my son is mortally embarrassed.
Would you care to comment on Justice Taylor's remark that the claim of the condemned was frivolous because they have no interest in knowing whether they are, of how they're to be executed? It's similar to nylon rope and
right.
Cotton rope, I believe.
His analogy, yes. I think we all saw, unfortunately, in graphic detail, why it does matter and why the FDA exists, why drugs are regulated, why drugs that come from non-FDA-regulated sources should be known. As we said all along in our case, if we're going to execute people, there's no reason that we should keep it secret, and there's no reason that we should violate the law when we do it.
Let me just say, I found that remark by Justice Taylor to be the most appallingly embarrassing moment of the litigation. That was the comment that was quoted in national news reports and international news reports. It's inconsistent with precedent, history, federal regulations, and I think it's going to be, you know, one of those quotations that reverberate through time in memories of how Oklahoma has handled some cases.
Scott, do you have anything you want to add to this?
Really don't.
Okay.
The posture of that litigation was very complicated in terms of which court had jurisdiction, and it became very political.
No, I, as a prosecutor, that I really can't shed any light on any of that. You all can draw your own conclusions about what happened there and the end result.
And David?
It's been said that Oklahoma is by far the number one per capita death penalty state in the nation, by far. And also, so, but what's the question is how do we actually change that or reverse it? Is it through petition? Is it through gubernatorial or legislative? What are the methods to actually do what most states are doing and what seems like is the arc of history to eliminate the death penalty in Oklahoma?
Well, it's purely political. Either your elected representatives and senators could change the law, or by initiative petition, which is a right you still have in Oklahoma, you could change the law in that regard. And again, that's what I was saying at the outset here. Challenges to particular executions are brought as legal challenges. But what you're really talking about here is whether people believe that imposing capital punishment is right or wrong. Now, of course, the only mechanism, if you are opposed to the death penalty, and you live in a state like Oklahoma where that is the law of the land right now, of course the only mechanism you have to challenge that is through some legal challenge. In this case, challenging the source of the drugs. And I don't mean that's a wrong thing to do at all. But I think that people on both sides of this argument have to remember that they're not really talking about the process. They're not really talking about, in other words, people who do not agree with the death penalty as a criminal sanction, there is never going to be a process that satisfies them. People who believe that there is nothing just except capital punishment are never going to find a method of capital punishment that really offends them.
Dr. Tepper, do you want to take this as well?
Well, I do think it's a political process. I've taught law here for now almost 35 years, and I can't say that I've seen much progress on the issue, but I think it's going to require the development of a larger, idealistic, influential sector of the Oklahoma population to change the politics of the state. And I don't know exactly how that's going to happen anytime soon.
I got one more question here, and then Doctor, and then I'm going to get to Batch in just a moment. So right over here.
I'm a writer here in Oklahoma, and I had the dubious distinction of witnessing the botched execution. And it was a horrible thing. So I guess I'm wondering if you two gentlemen would be in favor of broadcasting these executions, because I'd love to, make it possible for other people to experience what I experienced.
No, I think that would be horrible.
Do you think that would reduce the amount of
executions? I think it'll desensitize.
Well, it didn't desensitize people when Cronkite showed the Vietnam War, or when the networks showed the dogs and the water hoses that were an integral part of the South's resistance to the civil rights marchers. So I'm really wondering if it might be a positive thing. People need to see what it actually is about. Don't you agree?
Well, I do think they have to see what it's all about, but I do think you're going to have a number of executions that don't pose that spectacle, similar to the Cronkite images or what you saw, and I think over a period of time it will lose force. And when they start broadcasting, they may start doing a better job of the execution, but I don't really think it's going to generate more opposition. I could be wrong, but I also don't think it's a likely prospect.
Scott, would it change anything for prosecutors?
No, it really wouldn't. But there again, and I could give you a big long speech, but I can see by the look on your face you're short on time. So I don't disagree with anything the doctor said.
Okay, one final question.
Sure.
A comment and a question. We all know that the majority of Oklahomans support capital punishment, but not everyone does. And I think what legislators and the governor, elected officials, have to learn is that there are people who do oppose the death penalty. And so I would encourage people to go to the website of the Oklahoma Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty and sign up as members and make your voice heard, and maybe you'll learn something too. Anybody can go to that website. It's okcadp.org, okcadp.org. And I would just ask both of you to comment. Since 127 countries in the world have already abolished capital punishment, what do you think might be the one or two arguments that could sway Oklahomans, as you know the state?
As I know the state, and again, I'm gonna posture, mentally think of jurors. I like to talk to jurors afterward, and that's probably the only claim I have to measure, have my finger on the pulse of any Oklahomans. One thing is to the degree that there is always a risk of a falsely accused, someone being wrongfully executed, that horrifies most jurors. The more likely they believe that that is to have happened or that will happen, I think that more people would be swayed and probably not want to take that risk. Secondly, this is insider baseball, but when people realize as victims, when people who are involved in it as surviving victims realize what is going to be asked of them in terms of endurance and stamina, once the death penalty is imposed, before it's ever carried out, if it is ever carried out, I see so many of them just wilt and say, can we just plead them to life without parole? So those are the two things that I see that seem to make the most difference. Again, I'm just going to be blunt with you. They're paying me nothing here tonight, so I've got no pay they can dock. I don't see that people care much about the cost. I understand why folks like you, who I know to oppose the death penalty, are looking at every single possible argument. I've never seen that carry much weight. And on the other side, when we talk about the heinousness of the crime, I find myself going, well, but if it's right or wrong, there's no such thing as a crime that's so heinous that that which was wrong suddenly becomes right. I see both sides in searching for arguments to try and support what are really just deeply held beliefs. That's the bottom line.
Dr. Tepper, let's go and give you the final word, and then we're going to wrap this up.
I can foresee only one game changer I can think of. That doesn't mean there aren't others, but that's if it's documented that Oklahoma puts an innocent person to death. I think Oklahomans will rethink.
There you go. And we thank you again so very much for showing up. Dr. Rick Tepker, Scott Rowland from the Oklahoma County District Attorney. And let's keep it going for Picasso's for letting us come in. Thank you so very much. And I want you to give yourselves a round of applause because this has been a wonderful conversation tonight. We were very worried about it, and you did a great job. This is a really tough subject. We know that, and that's why we want to have discussions like this. If you enjoyed it, thank you so very much. We'll be putting it on the website, so if you want to send people over to listen to that, that'd be great. Again, thank you very much. Thanks to Picasso's, and everybody have a great night.